Since 2009, Kevin Williams has taken an interest in food storage and prepping. He really took it seriously in 2014. While not a prepper yet, he created a podcast where we can come together to talk about canning and other means of food storage, homesteading, gardening, farming, ranching, prepping, and politics. That's why this is called Canning Plus 7. Canning Plus 7 Other Topics. Now here is the Canning Plus 7 Podcast with Kevin Williams.
Welcome to the Canning Plus 7 Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Williams, the Blind Montana Man, podcasting to you from Billings, Montana. This episode of the Canning Plus 7 Podcast is in three parts. I interviewed a person named Shannon Brooks. Shannon Brooks is the owner of Monticello College in Monticello, Utah. Now, for those of you that don't know where Monticello is, it's down by the Four Corners area over by Moab, that area down there. Shannon Brooks used to be he wasn't the owner, but he was one of the head guys of a college in Cedar City, Utah, which is about 45 minutes north of St. George, Utah, called George Wythe College, which eventually turned itself into a university. And then he went on to Monticello College. Well, I happened to have sat in a George Wythe class back in 2006. It was March of 2006. And brought up a scenario, which you'll hear about in the podcast, and I tied it all together in the third episode of this podcast titled Monticello College and Shannon Brooks. I loved researching and doing the podcast. As a matter of fact, you'll find out if you listen to part three of this episode at the very end, I said that the website was very uplifting, and it was. Talking about discussing how they teach living off the grid at the college, and of course getting a LIBRA education, not liberal arts. Liberal arts is part of it, but a LIBRA education. You'll find out all about a LIBRA education and what it is. By the way, please do not hesitate to send me an email. That's canning, C-A-N-N-I-N-G, P-L-U-S, the number 7, at protonmail.com. That's CANNINGPLUS, the number 7, at protonmail.com. I know it's confusing because when you found this podcast, you probably did canning plus sign the number 7. It did not let me do canning plus sign 7 when I set up the email. As a matter of fact, I'm going to see if I can do everything canning PLUS, the number 7. That way it's not so confusing. But in the meantime, send me an email, canning, C-A-N-N-I-N-G, P-L-U-S 7, at protonmail.com. While you're at it, go ahead and check out the Facebook page. That is canning, C-A-N-N-I-N-G, the plus sign, and then 7 on Facebook. All right, let's get into this episode. Monticello College and Shannon Brooks. It is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. I'm Kevin Williams. This is the Canning Plus 7 podcast. I know it's been a while since I've done a podcast. Shannon Brooks is my guest today. How are you, Shannon?
I'm good, Kevin. How are you?
Good. Shannon Brooks was I don't know if you were a pioneer or what, but you were definitely involved in a university. I guess you could call it George Wythe College, I guess is what it was called. Did you ever get into the university status?
Yes. Before I left, we had moved from college to university status because we were setting up a second campus.
Oh, okay. We'll get into that, by the way.
Yeah, sure.
Even though we're going to talk more about your new venture, but yeah, he was in charge of George Wythe College. Now, for those of you that don't know, George Wythe College started in 1992, and it was a college that really gave you a well-rounded view of the classics. Everybody from the forefathers to Karl Marx to John Calvin to probably Sigmund Freud, a lot of people. And How was that receptive, and what happened to, you don't have to get into all the details, what was the downfall of the university?
There were some difficult economic times that's probably led to the major issues. I think just a difference of opinion, a difference of vision, ultimately is what caused George Wythe to cease to exist.
Yeah, okay. Well, it was definitely a unique concept. I remember, we'll get into the main topic of today, don't worry, folks, but I remember being at George Wythe. It was in Cedar City, Utah, and I was sitting in a class with a friend of mine. I got permission to sit in, and it was a three-hour class talking about what started the Great Depression. And I feel as though I'm a pretty knowledgeable person, not as knowledgeable as others, but the conversation was so deep, I felt like everybody was talking over my head. Is that, and I think it's just because they read so much about it that it was, is that a pretty common reaction when someone comes in as a visitor to one of the classes?
I think so. I mean, it was common to, you know, you say a 3-hour class, typically we covered a book when we weren't covering general topics. And this is what we do at Monticello, Monticello College now, is that you'll read a book separately and then you all come together and discuss it. And so you tend to kind of go deep, you know, and if you were in a second or third or fourth year class, then of course, you know, you have several years of accumulation of the, all these other books that were covered in the previous years being mm-hmm. brought to play in that discussion. So it was probably not fair to somebody like yourself visiting. If you were in a third year class, you know, they've got 100 and some books that they've read and already discussed and now bringing that to bear in that discussion, you know.
I'll tell you what I remember the most, and we will get on topic here, folks, but bear with me because this will actually set the stage for our conversation. So bear with me. What I remember the most about that, though, is we were talking about FDR and false sense of security. And we were talking about, is welfare a false sense of security? I raised my hand and said yes and no. Yes, if you are going to live on it forever and ever and ever, absolutely. If you are using it to get a step ahead and you're using it as a safety net for a temporary thing, no. And so we got into an interesting discussion about that, and then we talked about how much should government be in charge of our lives. And I raised my hand and I said, there are times where I think it's necessary. For instance, me as a blind person, where I have been unable to access the Target website. Now, keep in mind, folks, this is back in 2005, 2006. There was a big lawsuit going on against Target because it wasn't accessible. And and rightfully so, somebody raised their hand and said, well, why don't you go to another website? Well, I can. Walmart's more user-friendly. Well, why don't you go there? And my point was, we were trying to set a precedence in the blind community that, hey, you're a big corporation. Your website's not accessible. You better get with the program here because you're losing thousands of customers or a few thousand customers, and you could make more money if your website is accessible. And furthermore, you have a moral obligation to do so, was the school of thought of mine at that time. And so we got an interesting discussion, and I didn't know this, but months later, I found out that the students in the class, even though some of them were argumentative with me, and rightfully so, because it is a liberal arts college, the students, found me to be a breath of fresh air. And the professor the next day said, we don't have all the answers to life's problems. We need to appreciate other viewpoints. Now, what would your response be through that whole scenario that I just described?
Well, you know, as you're going through that, some ideas come to mind. So this is just off the cuff. But
yeah,
does a private business have a moral responsibility to ensure that everyone can access it? What if it doesn't, you know, could a private company, again, this is just, you know, devil's advocate, is it okay for a private company to have biases, to maybe not like blind people, you know, so they're doing everything in power so they don't have to interact with blind people, for example. Do they have a right to do that? And there's a school of thought that says yes, and there's another school of thought that says no. And mm-hmm. so you could go in a lot of different directions with this, but it would sure be, yeah, great fodder for an in-depth discussion. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was actually surprised at the professor's response to the next day. Of course, I wasn't there, but I'm not going to mention any names, but she came up, she actually picked me up because I was in Salt Lake City months later. And she picked me up to drive me back to my apartment. She said that I was a breath of fresh air, and I thought, oh, okay. But yeah, you know, these are the arguments that you get into at George Wythe. And well, you did, and I'm sure you get into these same arguments at your college, correct?
Absolutely.
And that's speaking of your college, start first. How did you get into George Wythe, and then how did you get into Monticello College? Let's start there. Let's start with your background, where you came from, something significant about your childhood, how you got into George Wythe, and how you got into Monticello College.
Sure. So I actually grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and one thing led to another, and I ended up
where in the Pacific Northwest?
East or west of Seattle, a place called probably the largest town there you would recognize would be Bremerton, between Bremerton and Paulsboro, little place called Silverdale. And I grew up on an LDS church welfare farm. And then I worked on various dairies and stuff in the area. So it was pretty much a farming background for me until I left home. So I had no particular desires to go into education. It wasn't until I served in LDS mission, I served in the military, I was out, I was in college, I was an older college student, I was late 20s. And I ran into a guy by the name of Cleon Skousen that kind of rocked my world. And one thing led to another. I ended up meeting the founder of George Wythe, who was Oliver DeMille. And we kind of got connected at the hip for the next 20 years or so. And as we built George Wythe College, later George Wythe University, basically, it was out of the desire to create something that was no longer existed in the United States. We couldn't find any colleges like, you know, the beginnings of William and Mary and others. So we started that school. George Wythe, by the way, was a big, big natural law icon for Virginia back in the founding period. Was very influential in the whole founding of this country. Hence George Wythe College and then university. By 2006, 2007, we were up to well over 100 students on campus. We had several hundred students in a distance program. And we were considering, we had been looking all over the country to kind of have our own place. You know, Cedar City is kind of the home of SUU, and it was great to be there, but we kind of wanted our own town. You know, Hillsdale's got Hillsdale and SUU's got Cedar City.
Yeah.
Provo's got BYU. We wanted our own place. So we've been looking around forever, and somebody volunteered to donate some land to us in a place called Monticello, Utah, which is about an hour south of Moab. We're at 7,500 feet above sea level. It was perfect for what we were looking for, a remote location. And so we attempted the process, or began the process, of setting up a second campus. We were going to keep the campus in Cedar City, set up a second campus and in Monticello, and started out good, ended up not so great. We had some real falling out within the leadership of the school. Oliver and I ended up leaving George Wythe in 2009. And by 2016, George Wythe had gone defunct and has not been in existence since then. So in 2010, so I left in 2009, 2010, a bunch of friends got with me and said, hey, we need to continue on what we were doing at George with, since it looks like that's not going to happen long term with them. So we came back. We were already still living in Monticello. So we started Monticello College and trying to keep that connection with Thomas Jefferson and such. And we started officially in 2010, had started full-time program on our 82-acre campus here in 2016 and are in our seventh year now.
Wow. Okay. So let's back up a little bit here. For those of you that don't know, Shannon said that he met Cleon Skousen. How old were you when you met him?
28 or 29.
Okay. And where did you meet him at? I'm sorry.
I was living in Phoenix metropolitan area at the time.
Oh, and how did you come across him?
I really don't know. I can't remember. I was working at a law firm in Phoenix. I was going to school as a paralegal, and I was working in a law firm. And somehow or another, I heard about him speaking. He would speak 320 times a year. He was a prolific speaker. And he was in Arizona doing about three nights of lectures in different parts of the valley there, Chandler and Mesa and such. And so I heard about him, went to something like on a Wednesday night, called in sick for the rest of the week and hit every one of his locations. And next thing I know, I was working as a volunteer in his organization.
Now, what year was this? Just to set a premise of time.
1989.
Okay. Yeah. So for those of you that don't know who Cleon Skousen is, he is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints. And no, this is not going to be a Latter-day Saint only podcast, but Shannon and I are a member of that church, so it's going to come up. But he wrote a book called, actually, he wrote a few. He wrote one called The 5,000-Year Leap, which is a book that Glenn Beck recommended. He also wrote The Naked Communist and The Naked Capitalist. Glenn Beck also recommended those, although he did put more emphasis on The 5,000-Year Leap. Just to give you an idea of who Cleon Skousen is. And so now, okay, so Monticello, give us a little bit of a clue for those that don't know. Monticello is in Utah, over by the Four Corners area in eastern Utah, over by Blanding, Moab, and those places.
Correct.
Near the Four Corners. What is it like out there, though? Is it deserty? What are the people like? Well, what's it like geographically?
Yeah, and if I can just back up for 1 second, Kevin.
Yeah.
I think it's important to realize that Cleon Skousen was an attorney. He was employed for some time by the FBI. He had been the chief of police of Salt Lake City. He was a professor at BYU for some time. So, you know, he had quite a resume. It wasn't just some guy that wrote a book. He was well known in the church circles. He was well known in the circles of liberty, and, you know, had done quite a bit all over the country. Very well known. Okay, so back to your question. Yeah, it's really interesting when you live at these kind of elevations, and it is, you literally can see the eco changes from one area to the next, right? And so at 7,500 feet, we're still in what we call sagebrush, scrub oak, juniper, just barely starting to move into the big evergreens, right? So I was at 7,500 feet. We have a lot of what's called scrub oak here. It's not technically high desert, but that's kind of what it feels like. The soil's not great, so we're doing a lot of improvement of the soil. But we're just a stone's throw from us is where all the big evergreens are starting to pop up, and then of course it's nothing but huge evergreens all the way to the peak of Abajo Mountain, which is at 11,200 feet.
Wow. Okay. So you've got your college there, but not only do you do a liberal arts education, you also do what's called manual arts, where that is where you teach people how to do physical things such as living off the grid, more so, I guess you could say, build your own home out of straw, which we'll talk about later. You teach people how to farm, how to butcher animals and such. It's very intense. You also assign mentors. through, I assume that the mentor lasts the whole 4 years that you're there or whatever, correct?
Yeah. So there's, so to really put it, you know, in an organized fashion, what we teach here is what we call LIBOR education. So it combines the liberal arts with the humanities, with manual arts, with a very intense abundance mentality, a producer mentality, and then what we call practical spirituality. So we have those five things combined are what we call LIBOR education. We typically spend most of our time talking about the relationship between the liberal arts and the manual arts. And you know, we're not necessarily saying that you have to go off grid. I mean, you could be grid tied. There's all kinds of things you can do, but we are encouraging a very strong means of, you know, controlling, owning and controlling your own means of production, including energy. And so that's where the off-grid model comes in. If I had a student who built their own home and had their own business, those kind of things, but was tied into the grid, I would still say they're following our program, but we just encourage that, you know, the more you control of these things yourself, the more independent you are, come a crisis, come inflation, come whatever. So, yeah.
Now, one thing you mentioned, manual arts. What is the difference between manual arts and industrial arts? Because I looked at that and I was a little confused. I think I know, but go ahead and tell us.
Yeah. So, you know, we would probably include the industrial arts in the overall concept of manual arts. But when we say manual arts, what we're talking about is your hands in the dirt, growing food, animal husbandry, knowing how to use a shovel, knowing how to use a pitchfork, knowing how to use hand tools, knowing how to use power tools, being able to take advantage of your body and, you know, be able to work hard with it and understand how to do things. It's amazing to me. There's a tool that you use on a farm a lot. It's called, we call it a digging bar. And it's amazing how people don't know how to use that, or a shovel or a hoe or a rake. And as these kids develop, on our website, there's if you go to the micro semester section, there's a video there. And it's just very encouraging for me to hear the students on that video talk about learning how to use an axe and how to chop wood and how fulfilling that was to realize that I can do something physical. You know, I don't have to depend on others. And mm-hmm. That's the whole point. That's the primary point of the manual arts, is to learn that you can, that you're independent and you could depend on yourself and get things done.
Well, that's definitely a skill that admittedly I don't have much of. I know how to use a shovel. I know how to dig, but I could not plant a tree right now if you told me to. And I'm sure that's probably
come on down,
the case
Kevin.
For most
we'll,
people.
We'll give you some instruction. No problem.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you do at this university is you have what's called micro semesters. And I find it interesting. I was on the website looking at the testimonials. I found it interesting that most of the people were 16, at the age of 16. Is there a reason for that? And explain to us, I guess with the micro semester, it lasts 26 days. And you have to read 3 books before you come. What books are those that you have to read? And do you have a mentor during that 26-day period as well?
Yeah. So let's touch on mentors for a second, just so we get okay. clear on what that means. And then I'll go to micro semester.
Yeah.
So you can have a number of different mentors in your life. What we do here is we call a professor or an instructor in the classroom, we call that an academic mentor. That man or woman is an academic mentor, and they're the ones walking through your classes. Because we have a small or a low student to teacher ratio, often that mentor also ends up being a life mentor for you. So you've got your classes and your books you're going through, but then you have some issues in life. That you want to talk to somebody other than your parents, maybe an adult. And often that academic mentor in our scenario ends up being that life coach. or that life mentor, but it could be somebody else too. When I was at George Wythe, I didn't teach any classes for the most part. I was administration, but I had a number of kids who would seek me out because of my personality or whatever. And they would, and that just happened to work for them. There were plenty of people who did not seek me out, but there were those who did, because we just jived. We had a connection somehow, and they felt comfortable sharing their situation and asking for advice and that kind of thing. And that happens all the time here. For example, I have a mentor who lives on campus. His name is Mark Anderson. Mark is kind of over our entrepreneurial efforts here. He's in charge of all construction on campus. And some kids, they feel real connected to him. They'll go talk to him about their lives. We have another mentor by the name of Vern Cox. He's a much older gentleman, and some people really, really like him. And even though he teaches classes, they will seek him out for other than academic pursuits and ask his advice and that kind of thing. So that's kind of how we handle mentors here. Going back to the micro semester, it depends. What we do is we have four times a year, depending on the year, where we can allow micro semesters. And we just take a 26-day period out of the existing schedule. And so you might have a lot of books. It could be 6 books, or it might be 3 or 2. It all depends on where you're getting embedded in that program. For example, the second micro semester this year, which is in July, the end of July, we're doing a straw bale build. And that build there's a week-long workshop for those who aren't enrolled in the school to come and help us. But for those who are here during that build, they're going to be here spending half of their time at least working on that new building, that straw bale building that we just put up. After the workshop is long over, these kids will continue to do plaster and interior finish work, those kinds of things. And that's part of that straw bale. That's part of that micro semester they signed up for. They know that it's heavy in manual arts for that particular micro semester. When people ask about micro semesters, they're checking with me to see, well, is this academic heavy? Is this liberal arts, or is this manual arts heavy? And they decide based on what we're doing in a particular micro semester, which one they want to do.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into straw bale. And let's keep on the liberal arts education. The liberal arts education, you mentioned on your website that there's, I believe, 5 components: the humanities, manual arts, which we've already gone over, and the spiritual aspect of liberal arts education. And you also mentioned that you do something, I guess you build, and part of my ignorance here, what is an adobe? I've heard that you can build an adobe. Is that some kind of a Native American house or something? I've heard that word before. We're not talking about Adobe Audition or Adobe Acrobat, folks.
Yeah, so let me just clarify.
Yeah.
There's a difference between library education and liberal arts education. Liberal arts education is a component in liber education. So liber education, again, liberal
liber
arts.
Is L-I-B-E-R, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Liber happens to be the root word for liberty, for library, for liberal. And so we're saying that there's an education system that we promote that is based around the concept of liber. And that includes the liberal arts, humanities, manual arts, abundance mentality, spiritual side of it, all that. So the spiritual component, it's not denominational or anything. It's simply saying, hey, we acknowledge that there's a creator. We acknowledge that we have, because there's a creator, we have a relationship with mankind, human to human, and we're held accountable for that. In the 5,000-year leap, which you mentioned earlier, Benjamin Franklin is quoted in talking about what he referred to as the American religion. And it's just the idea of, you believe in deity. There's we have a responsibility one to another as human beings. And what we do in this life, we're held accountable in the next life. And that's pretty much where we're at with practical spirituality. We don't promote any particular denomination. We do learn about all the major world religions, but we don't particularly promote one, but we do pray when we start every class. And there's a lot of, depending on the students, some students bring a lot of scripture into their studies. Some students don't. That's not something that's necessarily led by a mentor. That's student driven. Now back to Adobe. Adobe is basically a mud brick, and you can make buildings out of Adobe. You can also do the same thing with Cob, which is similar. There's compressed earth blocks that you can use, which are more intense than Adobe. Adobe is probably the most basic, most elementary approach to this. But there's Adobe buildings that have been around for hundreds of years. As long as they, you know, stay dry, keep the weather off them, they last just fine. They can take a certain amount of weight in terms of, you know, roof load, that kind of thing. That's what Adobe is.
Well, okay. So I want to get onto this topic a little bit more. It sounds like what you're telling me is going back to the biblical times in terms of building these adobes, correct?
Well, I'm not sure I would call it, you know, an effort to go back to biblical times or anything, but it certainly is an effort to find inexpensive building methods that mm-hmm. last a long time. Compressed earth blocks, for example, and we don't have any code in the state of Utah that I'm aware of for compressed earth block, but they're put through a machine. I had my blocks tested that we made here. Code in New Mexico required 300 PSI per block, and our blocks were doing 900 PSI. So we were way above the standards that the state of New Mexico was requiring. When you build with these things, all that means is it can take a massive, massive roof load right on the load bearing wall, right? And if you keep it dry and keep a good plaster on there, those buildings are rated for about 300 or 400 years. So, and yeah, you go through the Middle East, there's all kinds of places all through that part of the world that has mud buildings, has adobe brick buildings, those kinds of things that have been around for millennia.
Now, I understand, though, and this is what I want to be clear, and this actually has a lot to do with prepping. If one of these adobes gets wet, you're screwed. Am I correct? If it rains or something, because this was an issue in biblical times, they were building houses like this.
Right. And that's why I don't do Adobe. We show them what it is, but I would never build a building out of Adobe. I would build buildings out of Cob. That seems to be much more resilient. Compressed earth block has about 10% cement in it. It does melt. If you leave it out in the weather, it will melt over a couple of years, but when we build with them, we don't leave them, you know, they have 3, 4, 5 foot overhangs on these buildings. It has a lime plaster on the outside, which is very weather resistant. And so it's pretty easy to keep the stuff dry and out of the weather. But yeah, if you lost the roof off your house, for example, and you built with Adobe, it would not take long for that to be just one big pile of mud.
Yeah, you wonder how people in biblical times got along with those type of things. This episode is continued on part 2 of the Canning Plus 7 podcast, Monticello College and Shannon Brooks.